From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations and comments featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Soundings now presents a discussion with the governors of Delaware, North Carolina, Tennessee, and Virginia about education, economic growth, and politics in the modern South. Governors James B. Hunt, Jr. of North Carolina, Pierre DuPont IV of Delaware, Lamar Alexander of Tennessee, and Charles S. Robb of Virginia recently came to the Research Triangle Park as members of a task force on education and economic growth. The task force was convened by the Education Commission of the states. The governor's appearance on Soundings was arranged through the office of President William S. Friday of the University of North Carolina. Beginning the conversation with Governors Alexander, DuPont, Hunt, and Robb is Dewey Grantham of Vanderbilt University. Professor Grantham recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a book about Southern politics.
I'm impressed in light of the history of the South with the quite remarkable educational progress made in all of the southern states, especially since World War II. It seems to me that this is somewhat, as I say, it's remarkable, somewhat ironical in light of the region's history. But throughout the century, I think the region, for a variety of reasons, lagged behind the country as a whole. Early in the 20th century, I think the region experienced an extraordinary educational crusade. Many of your predecessors were involved in that crusade. Still, it was difficult and progress was slow. It might be that in reflecting on this historical problem, we could move into more contemporary, a more contemporary era and talk about education and politics and economic development. So I wonder if any of you, perhaps Governor Hunt, would lead off if you want to respond to that question.
Well, I would. I think that the South was very poor for a long time, and we did not have as much education of our people for a long time as we now have. I don't think we really understood how you go about changing things, how you go about providing more good jobs and building an economy and providing greater opportunities for people. Once we sort of got educated as to how that happens and learned that it happens through better education made available for all people, and of course in 1945, we still had segregation, and we weren't really doing it for all people, though we may have said so at the time. But once we learned that, once we learned that it was possible for us to grow economically and that you had to have good education, you had to have good skill training, then I think we decided that's what we wanted to do, and we got very committed to it. I think the business industrial community, which was rapidly developing in our area after the war, certainly after the Korean War, began to be a very strong force there. Of course, we still lag in terms of the dollars spent, but I saw some figures recently comparing, well, at least pointing out the percentage of the state budget spent for the public schools in one of the northern states, which is generally considered to have an excellent educational system. They were spending between 30% and 35% of their budget for their public schools K through 12. In North Carolina, that figure is over 40%, for example, and I suspect it is in most of the southern states. So I think our effort is very strong now, and I think it's just been a matter of catching up, understanding gradually, and certainly after World War II, what process you had to follow to get up and get out, so to speak. And because we believe, I think, very deeply in the South, in human beings, we want them to have a better opportunity. I think all of that, sort of our value system, our work ethic, all of those things have come to, we've sort of put those things together. as a strong force behind education.
Gentlemen, let me ask you to reflect on from a perhaps a more current contemporary standpoint on the connections among and between education and politics and economic growth. You have come to the Research Triangle Park and to the National Humanities Center as part of a task force on those connections with the Education Commission of the States. Do you see a disparity between economic growth and education? And if you do, how do you intend to close the gap that's there? Governor Alexander?
I think it's pretty clear that our jobs are about as good as our schools today. While we've heard a lot about the progress we've made in the southern states, and it's not the same in every state over the last several years, on the whole, the southern states, with the exception of Virginia, Florida, and Texas, have an average family income that is 80, 83, 84% of the national average. We're still a good deal poorer than most places in the country. And despite the fact that during the 60s and the 70s our jobs grew a lot faster, we've not had a big economic boom overall since about the mid-70s in the South. So our schools and our jobs and our relative level of education falls significantly behind the rest of the country. And we have to do more to catch up. So the great strides that Jim Hunt and others have made in North Carolina over the next 20 years and that we're trying to make in Tennessee and that Chuck Robb and Pete DuPont in their states have been making, we just simply have to do that to have any hope of catching up on an overall basis in the quality of jobs and the quality of schools. That's a little more pessimistic, I suppose, but I think it's an accurate reflection of where we are. We're moving more rapidly, but we have further to go.
Governor DuPont?
Well, let me add on to that. I think it's taken the people of the country, the South, the North, the West, everywhere, a long time to make the mental and intellectual connection between education and economic development. For many, many years, they were thought to be quite separate. And indeed, going back to the first question on the program, I think before World War II, the general belief was that education was in one little box over here and jobs were in another box over here, and they had nothing to do with each other. World War II began to dispel that myth, and when America went to war in 1941 and people from all regions of the country came together in the armed forces, fought the war, talked to each other, exchanged ideas, and when they came home in 1945 and 1946, they brought home a whole new set of ideas with them. And one of those was that education and economic expansion came hand in hand. And I think that was just the beginning of the educational effort that had to be undertaken to get people to see that if you were going to build a Research Triangle industrial base, you had to have the educational base to go with it. And similarly, if you started with your education, you could then begin to attract jobs. So that process has taken a long time, which is why I think it's been rather slower than a lot of us would have wished.
Your connection there, it seems to me to be a very valid one. But I wonder if there isn't another point that is related to the World War II experience, and that is the rapid economic development, industrialization, in migration and so on, that the war brought, and its aftermath as well. In short, is it true that the South, in particular, benefited from economic development in its educational progress? In other words, education, economic and industrial development was a prelude to educational development. Would you comment on that?
One of the things, let me just comment, if I may, that picks up on the comment that Pete DuPont made, and that relates to the whole development of the Sun Belt phenomenon that is, in some cases, of somewhat more recent vintage, but the recognition that we had, the South was making a relatively fundamental transformation, as the rest of the nation was, but perhaps more evident here, from a basically agrarian and entry-level jobs predominance to one that required more sophistication, and as the economic development aspects of the opportunities became more apparent, I think there was a recognition that we were going to have to keep pace in terms of the educational component. And if you bring that right up to date today, and that's one of the reasons for the conference that you referred to and many of the other things that are happening right now, is that the only way that the South and any of the individual states can compete for most of the expansion of the current economic base is by providing the kind of skills that are required for not only the entry-level jobs and some of the community college system for the technical training, but the advanced degree programs for the senior management personnel. And that whole development simply is a direct cause and effect relationship that it seems to me is inevitable. And it's a matter of survival in addition to a matter of good public policy.
Governor Hunt?
I think it's important, though, that we distinguish between why industry may have come into the South, say after World War II or after the Korean War, versus why it is apt to be coming now. You know, as Southerners, we would be reluctant to admit this, but I think a lot of industry probably did come to the South because we had a good climate, we had low taxes, and we had labor that you didn't have to pay very much to. Well, some of those things still exist, but the kind of business and industry that we're increasingly moving into, which is more highly automated, it requires higher skills, it is more technologically sophisticated, that kind of industry, in a sense, requires a different kind of capital structure. It's not industry in which you necessarily are putting a lot of money into huge buildings or even great big pieces of machinery, though we still would like to have more of that kind of so-called heavy industry in the South. But the knowledge-intensive kinds of industries, all of the word processing and knowledge kinds of industries that are coming along now, really depend on human capital. And so we have to, it's no longer cheap labor, it's no longer low taxes, and it isn't even necessarily where the climate is best, but it is people who have been well educated, who have the ability to adapt and to change as technological innovation comes along. So what made the South attractive at one point and sort of gave us a leg up in a sense, thank goodness we had that, no longer serves us well and increasingly will not serve us well in the future. That's why we've got to be prepared to have the best workers. And that's why we really have to do this job of education for all of our people. We're not just talking about a few scientists or people who are going to develop new mathematical theories that may be very important. That's important, though. That's that talented group. That's what we're trying to work with at the Mass Science High School and so forth in Durham. But we're talking about everybody who works on that assembly line and those workbenches. Those have got to be people who can develop new ideas for quality, things that we can do to get us ahead, a little better way to do this or provide a service or a little better good. That's the new thing we've got to do, and that means excellence in education. And we in the South have made a lot of progress, but we've got a long way to go before we get that true excellence.
But it has a payout. What Jim Hunt says is true, but it has a payout in economic development that we've seen very directly in Delaware. We lost a major manufacturing firm to the Research Triangle solely on the argument that the engineers who worked there wanted to be, when they had to build a new facility somewhere, wanted to be in the kind of educational community that the Research Triangle had to offer. And the particular area of Delaware where this plant was did not have that to offer. So once you begin to build that educational base, you get industry saying, we want to be associated with that and we want to be close to it. So it serves as a very powerful magnet to jobs.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to a discussion of education, economic growth, and politics in the contemporary South. The panelists are Governor Lamar Alexander of Tennessee, Pierre DuPont IV of Delaware, Charles S. Robb of Virginia, and James B. Hunt, Jr. of North Carolina. Also participating in the conversation is Professor Dewey Grantham of Vanderbilt University, who has recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a book about 20th century politics in the South.
Gentlemen, let me ask you this. What should be the general and some of the specific roles of state government in developing the connections that bind education to economic growth? How do you go about creating a constituency that's going to be responsive to the goals that you've been discussing? Governor Alexander?
Well, I think governors have a big role in that. And I suspect that governors can be faulted, generally speaking, over the last 20 years by their lack of interest in education and their lack of focus on the relationship between their failure to make the point that better schools mean better jobs, and as Pete DuPont just said, usually vice versa. So what we can do, states, governors especially, is number one, set an agenda. Like in our state, we have a so-called Better Schools program, 10 points. Basic skills, computer skills, new job skills, alternative schools, programs for the gifted, incentive pay program for teachers, and the governor can, and the state government can set that agenda and help persuade everybody else. Second, the state is usually the best planner and leader for recruiting of new jobs. All of us do that. We spend a lot of time doing that. In fact, the agenda for schools and the agenda for jobs is probably 80-85% of what we do as governors and what we're likely and our predecessors are to be doing for the next 10 years. So what we can do with parents and students is remind them that while we can lead, they're going to have to do it. And that I think it may be time for an awakening of interest in the importance of public education. That's going to be pretty hard to do too, because I think people have gotten so turned off in the last 20 years, they're afraid that anything they say and do, even about their neighborhood school, doesn't make any difference, and so they don't do anything.
I don't think you have to be quite that pessimistic. I'll tell you who knows that a good education system's important, and that's the kids. If you go into a high school and talk to juniors or seniors, they know they're going to graduate and have to get a job. And they're very, very concerned about the quality of their education system. And I think that begins to reflect when they go home in the evening and talk to mother and dad about what's going to happen to me next year. So I'm a little more optimistic than Lamar Alexander, perhaps. I think it's beginning to pull itself up by its bootstraps.
Obviously, the bottom line in anything that we do in this area, however, is money and the way we assess our priorities. And I think one of the things that all of the governors and the state legislature and others have recognized is that if we're serious about upgrading our potential in this area, we're going to have to commit additional resources to education across the board. And I think each of the governors that are represented, the states that are represented here by governors and others have made this kind of a commitment, have established that as a priority. In Virginia, for instance, we're in the process right now of asking a number of other state agencies to find ways to do what they have done in the past for at least as little money as they are using currently without any increase in inflation to provide the same services or to find services that they can cut in order that we can provide additional money and incentives. And again, I would commend Governor Lamar Alexander of Tennessee for taking a real leadership position in finding ways to make the entire profession of the educator accountable, to find ways to reward excellence, to identify excellence in the teaching profession. I think that there's no question that most of the citizens, the parents that you're talking about, and ultimately the students, are prepared to spend more of their tax dollars on education if they think they're going to get a positive return on their investment. More of the same will not suffice, but if they think they're going to get a better product, if they think they're going to find that they're graduating students that are better prepared for the workplace and not simply continuing to do what they have simply done in the past, which may or may not lead to productive work relationship in the future, they're willing to pay for it. And that's where we ultimately establish our priorities.
Governor Hunt?
I think the task force on education to economic growth is making recommendations that will work in the South, particularly well in the South, maybe better than any place else in this country, but that are of the kind that the country is going to have to pursue if we're going to make America work better. For example, the top two recommendations that the task force has made are, first of all, that in order to provide excellent education for economic growth, that we need to have a state plan developed in each state, that the governor should take the lead in doing that, but that the governor should get the help of all the other leadership in the state. Now, that involves the private sector and the public sector. And traditionally in the South, governors have worked extremely closely with the private sector. We've been willing to reach out and join hands with everybody, government, non-government. It's just sort of a partnership kind of approach, but with government taking the lead, and governors, of course, must specifically be the leader. So that state plan, getting everybody to kind of be a part of it, is important. The second thing is the business of what we call partnerships, related to the first, but here we specifically recommend that business and industry get involved directly in helping make schools excellent. That means speaking up for schools. It means, of course, making some of their own resources, including their people, available. It means pushing to get the kinds of appropriations we need to have. Business people can oftentimes go in and come near getting a state legislature to approve appropriations for education than teachers can, or parents, or what have you. But that business of getting everybody to see it as their joint responsibility, business, industry, volunteers, we've got adopt-a-school programs that are going amazingly well in the South, all kinds of folks working as partners for their schools. Again, I think this draws on some of the kinds of values and ideas about community and people working together, the fact that we've known each other in the South, generally in our kinds of communities, and I think we can make that work extremely well. I happen to think that this business of not having an antagonistic approach, but a cooperative approach, is the one that many nations in the world have used successfully, and that this country is going to have to learn to do.
It seems to me that all of the statements that you've made, eloquent statements, I might add, reflect what might be called the politics of education in the contemporary South. I wonder if you see the politics of education having changed in your own experience or historically in the South. That is, in light of interest group politics, partisan politics, how do you see your own roles as political facilitators? I'd be very interested in your reflections on this question, Governor Alexander.
Well, let me try that briefly. I think in practical politics in the last 20 years, 30 years, I think of two things. I think of only one governor of our state since Governor McCord in 1948-9, who really had a principal focus on education, and that was Governor Clement for part of his term. So during that period of time, the principal focus was something else. You didn't get elected on better schools, or at least those who got elected didn't use that as a principal focus. Second, I think as a matter of practical politics, a major factor has been the rise of influence of the teachers' union in the South and its impact on politics. In our state, for example, the teachers' union, the Tennessee Education Association, has a budget of about $3 million, 39 employees, working full-time, and the State School Board Association has a budget of $300,000, six or seven employees working full-time, and the teachers' union has a major impact on the election of at least legislators, not governors lately, and in our state, and I think that's just something that has to be dealt with as a practical matter of fact. In fact, I think to a large degree, educational policy has become heavily influenced by the leaders of the teachers' associations and unions, and I think they have a perfect right to be there, but somehow in the process, a lot of other people have stayed home or gotten crowded out or not asserted themselves quite as strongly. And I think governors are among those who are going to have to stick their nose back in things in a big way and make sure all voices are heard. So those are two things in our state that have had a practical impact on politics.
I think the politics of education in Delaware has changed dramatically in the last decade. When I first began getting involved with the education question at the beginning of my first term as governor, back in the middle 1970s, educational lobbying in the legislature was very structurally oriented. That is, the interest groups that came in were the administrators who wanted a pay raise, the administrators who wanted more money for substitute teachers. They were looking at specific structural items. Well, in the last few years, that has dramatically changed. And the lobbying and the interest now is program and student-oriented, a gifted and talented program, a basic skills program, a school for excellence. A whole series of programmatic changes that are focused on making the things that happen to children in the educational system better. In the early 1970s and the mid-1970s, all the emphasis was on administration and structure. So I think there's been a change in thinking in the educational community.
Certainly in Virginia, there has been the same kind of change that Lamar and Pete have already described. The teachers are clearly the most visible and the most highly organized of those groups that have had an impact, and it's been because of the focus of their efforts that had not previously been much of a factor. They do exert a significant influence on legislatures, legislative elections, again because of their effort to recognize the importance of providing a very highly focused impact on that process. I think there's no question that in the higher education community, the old school tie, if you will, still is probably the most effective lobby. The graduates of particular institutions probably exert as much influence on the legislative process and ultimately the allocation of money as any other group. But in the K through 12 arena, the teachers have simply eclipsed all other groups by a significant margin. The relationship that Lamar pointed to, I think, is probably fairly typical for most of the states, and they have been able to recognize a return on that kind of investment, which is proportional. And of course, the whole change in the teaching profession and the increasing professionalization of that group has also played a significant role.
You've been listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond. The topic was education, economic growth, and politics in the modern South, the first segment in a two-part series. The panelists were Governors Lamar Alexander of Tennessee, Pierre DuPont IV of Delaware, James B. Hunt Jr. of North Carolina, and Charles S. Robb of Virginia. Governors Alexander, DuPont, Hunt, and Robb are members of a task force on education and economic growth, convened by the Education Commission of the States. They appeared on Soundings with the assistance of the Office of President William S. Friday of the University of North Carolina. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities.